This is Tuesday, the ninth day of May, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming up, North Korean voters went to the polls Tuesday to choose a new president.
This will end a decade of conservative rule, and it happened in a very dramatic and a very condensed time period.
We will hear from that man, VOA's Seoul Bureau Chief Brian Padden. Also ahead, the Trump travel ban is once again in the court. VOA's Victoria Maki has been covering the story. She'll join us. And the recently found remains of an early human ancestor could change theories about our ancient history. It's all on today's International Edition. Exit polls in South Korea are now forecasting the winner of the presidential election in that country. VOA's South Korean Bureau Chief Brian Padden joins us from Seoul. Brian, so far, what do the exit polls show?
As predicted by earlier surveys coming into the election, Moon Jae-in, the liberal leader of the Democratic Party of Korea, is projected to win the election with 41% of the vote. His closest rivals are 20 percentage points behind him. Overall, there was a field of 13 candidates.
A win by Moon, if it does hold up, would end a decade of conservative rule in South Korea and could result in some sharp departures from recent policy toward North Korea. Can you explain what they are?
Yes. First of all, let me agree with you that this will end a decade of conservative rule, and it happened in a very dramatic and a very condensed time period. It actually began last year with legislative elections in which the opposition parties gained the majority in the National Assembly for the first time, which led to an audit of the government, which led to revelations about this corruption scandal and elements of how the president might have colluded with a friend of hers to force major corporations, conglomerates like Samsung and Lotte Group to donate over $65 million to dubious foundations that was being used to pay for some of the president's supporters and friends on the side. So that led to the impeachment. Moon is a throwback to the early part of the 2000s, the sunshine period of engagement time in which the liberals who were in charge of North Korea at that time attempted to increase assistance, cooperation, aid, and dialogue to try to reassure North Korea and convince them that their nuclear weapons arsenal would not be needed. This policy eventually ended because North Korea, of course, did not give up its nuclear weapons and was secretly testing and developing uranium at secret test sites while accepting all this aid and development, and also creating a lot of different types of conventional provocations against South Korea. So the animosity grew over time, and it shifted to a much more conservative philosophy. But in the last year, what we have seen, the results of this much more aggressive, punitive, sanctions-oriented approach has not worked either. In fact, North Korea has accelerated its nuclear weapons and ballistic missile programs without any restraint of any possibility of losing aid or assistance, because that's all been cut off.
What does this mean, do you think, for the relationship between Seoul and Washington?
This is leading to some type of, likely some type of strain in the U.S. alliance. Moon has downplayed any particular issues. He characterized President Trump as somebody who will often make boisterous statements and talk tough, but ultimately wants the same thing as South Korea, as the Moon administration will want, and as the Chinese government wants, which is to bring Pyongyang back to the negotiating table. Now, Moon had early been skeptical about the deployment of the U.S. THAAD missile shield here in South Korea, for example, this was something that the U.S. had been pressing for a long time. And after the North Korean nuclear test last year, President Park Geun-hye's government agreed to deploy that system here. China was very upset about it. So Moon has played down the confrontation with him, but he's been reluctant to support THAAD under those circumstances. And then just recently, President Trump had come out with a very public demand that South Korea pay $1 billion for this THAAD deployment. And he pushed back very hard against this, saying that, you know, there's no way they would pay for this, that he did not support. He had doubts about it to begin with and would never support it under these terms.
Has there been any reaction yet from the North, from Pyongyang?
They have. North Korea, through its state media, has put out in the last week urging South Koreans to vote for the liberal side and condemning the conservatives in this race. But there has been no reaction yet to the announced exit poll results.
VOA South Korea Bureau Chief Brian Patton joining us from Seoul. Thanks, Brian. And we spoke to Brian just a little while ago, and since then, the liberal Moon Jae-in has declared victory in the presidential election, vowing to represent all of his country's people. Stay with us here on VOA for all of the latest news. Speaking of latest news, Andrew Palshevsky joins us, as he always does, scanning the social media throughout the world. And what are you finding? What's going to interest anybody beside you?
The immigration ban,
okay.
in a couple words. This is something that has interested a lot of people on social media ever since it was announced by President Trump, and it's getting a lot of attention again because of language on the White House website calling for a Muslim ban. After questions were raised on social media about this language being on the White House website, it was immediately pulled very quickly. So a lot of people noting that it was up there to begin with, and B, that it was quickly pulled. And then we're seeing a lot of talk about the so-called Muslim ban using the hashtag No Muslim Ban Ever. People actually from both sides using this, people saying that there should never be a ban on anyone basis of religion, others saying it's not a Muslim ban, it's a ban on countries that don't have proper vetting.
And we should say that VOA's Victoria Maki is gracing us with her presence today in the studio and will be with us just momentarily in a few minutes to talk more about that.
Yes, but we're seeing a lot of activism on social media, rallies in Richmond, Virginia, where the court there is taking up the arguments about this case. So we're continuing to see social media activity, and not just activity within the realm of social media, but driving these rallies and protests throughout the country.
All right. But we're going to continue here, and we'll be talking with Victoria Maki in just a moment. But first, we check the top stories in the world. Exit polls did project, and now the Liberal Democratic Party of Korea candidate Moon Jae-in has said he is the winner of the South Korean presidential election. The White House has postponed for a second time a key meeting on whether the United States should withdraw from the International Paris Climate Change Pact. The UN Refugee Agency says up to 245 migrants are missing and fear dead following shipwrecks in the Mediterranean over the weekend. The National Security Agency director says the United States faces almost one significant cyber event every day and faces a growing variety of advanced threats. Jakarta's Chinese Christian governor has been sentenced to 2 years in prison after being found guilty of blasphemy. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition, and this is VOA.
This is Science in a Minute.
A team of astronomers discovered another great spot on Jupiter that rivals the size of the giant planet's iconic Great Red Spot. The Great Red Spot is actually an ongoing high-pressure storm raging in its atmosphere with winds that can reach speeds of 430 to 680 kilometers per hour. The new discovery is called the Great Cold Spot because scientists think it's about 200 Kelvin cooler than the surrounding atmosphere, which they say can vary between 426 and 726 degrees Celsius. The researchers say the Great Cold Spot was created by the effects of the giant planet's magnetic field. Compared to the slowly changing Great Red Spot, the researchers say the Great Cold Spot is much more unstable and can dramatically change size and shape in only a few days or weeks. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. Andrew Palshevsky is with us. The much-challenged temporary travel ban issued by President Donald Trump faced another day in court yesterday, with federal appellate judges grilling lawyers on both sides to determine whether a suspension of the executive order will be upheld. VOA's Victoria Maki has been following proceedings. As a matter of fact, she just wrote the line that I just read. Victoria, thanks for being with us. Where's this now, Stan? Where is it all?
We are in the middle of everything. We're still waiting to hear from the judges that heard arguments from both sides yesterday in one appellate court in Richmond, Virginia. Next week, we have another hearing coming up in Seattle in a separate appellate circuit, the Ninth Circuit. So we are really just in a holding pattern, trying to figure out what these judges are going to rule, if they're going to uphold the suspension that's currently in place, or if they are going to overturn that suspension, which would, in essence, uphold Trump's executive order.
This is all heading toward the Supreme Court, one would imagine.
You know, Trump himself actually called for that and, you know, said, we'll see you in the Supreme Court. And I believe it was the end of April. So that does seem to be where this is eventually headed.
Some of the judges, I was listening to some of the arguments before the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals in Virginia yesterday. They seem to be focusing in, or at least some of the judges, on what President Trump has said in the past about what many consider to be a Muslim ban. Here's what the president said about all that during his campaign.
Donald J. Trump is calling for a total and complete shutdown of Muslims entering the United States until our country's representatives can figure out what the hell is going on.
So with that in mind, if that's where these judges and some of the judges on maybe the other appellate courts are going to focus, how did they fight that?
I mean, so this came up yesterday, and I suspect it will come up again next week in Seattle. I think that we saw repeated questioning yesterday regarding how much validity what Trump said along the campaign trail is going to play into what the judge's decision is going to be. You know, this wasn't just once that Trump said this. You know, it was a statement on his website, as Andrew, my colleague over here, mentioned. And this was a statement up on his campaign website up until yesterday. You know, for whatever reason, they hadn't taken it down. It was specifically referring to Muslim immigrants and travelers to the U.S. So that's what the attorneys for the plaintiffs have been arguing, that there is a basis before Trump even became president that really kind of carved the way for this executive order.
There's also a lot of talk about Sally Yates, who was the acting attorney general who was fired for refusing to enforce the immigration ban. She was testifying on Capitol Hill yesterday about Russia's involvement in the election, but there were some instances during that testimony in front of the Senate Judiciary Committee where they did indeed talk about this ban. There was one exchange with Senator Ted Cruz of Texas where he cited a statute that said the president has the authority to ban anyone that he feels may be a threat or from countries that may be threatening. And Yates shot back saying that there was an amendment to that, saying that they could not institute any kind of ban on the basis of race, religion, creed, those kind of things. So that video moment's getting shared around a lot. And as we're talking about the social media gearing up as these court cases are being heard, that's another moment that's added to the mix on social media, this back and forth on this immigration ban and whether or not it's constitutional.
Gee, I wonder, Victoria, if this social media, especially as being used by President Trump, is really going to have more of an impact on an eventual decision by a court, even be it the Supreme Court, than any other case in history.
You know, I'm not super familiar with the case law, and I don't know that this has actually ever been tested in a court before, at least at the presidential level. you know, just how much they'll take that into consideration. But, you know, Trump's in speeches all through the campaign, I mean, even before he started campaigning, I mean, even his Twitter stream is, I've looked at pretty much every tweet about immigration and immigrants and refugees, and there is a long history of him talking about this. So there's definitely a lot to choose from if you want to start picking apart, you know, what he said ahead of becoming president.
So, therefore, if someone, the bottom line here, if someone is listening now, wherever we're being heard around the world, and is wondering how long this is going to take before some decision is made, can you make any kind of prediction, especially if it goes to the Supreme Court?
No. I mean, that's the short answer. We just are in this holding pattern, like I said earlier, that we just have no idea when the Fourth Circuit will make a decision, and, you know, what that decision is going to look like. It's just a wait and see, and I know that affects a lot of people who are anxious to see family again or waiting on loved ones to come to the U.S. for whatever reason. So I wish we had, you know, some news to give them.
Aren't you glad that I asked you an unanswerable question?
Yeah, that's great. I know there's a lot of anxiety out there. I wish we could provide people with those answers, but we just don't have them right now.
VOA's Victoria Maki and VOA's Andrew Palczewski, thank you both for being with us. Greatly appreciate it. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics, from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. That's Press Conference USA, every Saturday and Sunday on VOA.
We continue on International Edition from the Voice of America. The United States is facing almost one significant cyber event every day and is facing a growing variety of advanced threats. That according to the director of the National Security Agency, Mike Rogers. Testifying before the U.S. Senate's Armed Forces Committee today, Rogers said the United States is falling behind when it comes to fighting off cyber attacks, and the country still has no cyber policy. The new team is working on that, is what he told the committee. Senator John McCain said he had expressed concerns about the lack of a policy in the past and said the Trump administration promised to produce a policy within 90 days of the inauguration. But, said Senator McCain, 90 days have come and gone. Let's move on now to a very interesting story coming out of South Africa. A team of paleontologists and anthropologists in South Africa says its newest discoveries around a recently found early human ancestor could change theories about our own ancient history. VOA's Anita Powell reports from the Cradle of Humankind World Heritage Site in Marapeng, South Africa.
The scientific team that made headlines in 2015 by unearthing a previously unknown ancient human relative says its latest discoveries could change the way we look at human evolution. The findings, which are being published this week in the scientific journal eLife, include the discovery of a second chamber of fossils of the small-brained hominin, Homo naledi, and the surprisingly young age of the fossils. The bones found in these fossil-rich caves northeast of Johannesburg were originally thought to be more than 2 million years old, making them a candidate as a possible human ancestor. Maybe even, some in the scientific community mused, the elusive missing link between higher apes and humans. However, independent tests of the unearthed fossils put them between 236,000 and 335,000 years old, which means that some of the species lived at the same time as ancient humans. The team's leader, paleoanthropologist Lee Berger of Johannesburg's University of the Witwatersrand, said that could mean that some artifacts and actions attributed only to early humans, things like tools, adornments, and burial of the dead, might not be our work after all.
That date corresponds with when most archaeologists and paleoanthropologists and genetics is suggesting we see the rise of modern humans. And a lot of people argue that rise is right here in southern Africa. But now there's another species here. Everything is very complex from this moment onward.
Among the cache of fossils in the second chamber, Berger says, is a nearly complete adult skull, which scientists nicknamed Neo, the Sesotho word for gift.
Neo, it gives us a real look at what the body and face of this incredible new species looks like. It tells us we were a little bit wrong. We had guessed there was a little bit more nose. Actually, Homo naledi has a little flatter, even more primitive face than we thought, which is one of the reasons that we place it further back in the sort of the family tree of relatedness to earlier hominids. It's clear that parts of Homo naledi from Neo are very, very, very primitive. Amongst the most primitive we see in hominids, and other parts are surprisingly advanced. They, in fact, are comparable mostly with us as humans.
Anthropologist John Hawks of the University of Wisconsin-Madison, an author on all three of this week's scientific papers, says this discovery could start a new era in his field.
There is so much unexplored territory out there. There are so many discoveries yet to be made that we're now just beginning what I think is the golden age. We're going to see more chambers like this, more fossil discoveries, and they're going to tell us things that we don't expect to see now.
There remain, Berger and Hawks say, many questions. Among them, are these fossils found inside narrow, hard-to-reach caves just 100 meters apart a tantalizing sign that Naledi buried its dead? How did this species survive for so long before going extinct? And why did it die out? Did it ever have contact with ancient humans? And what other clues are out there, just waiting to be unearthed? Anita Powell, VOA News, Marapang, South Africa.
You have been listening to International Edition. Thanks for joining us. Our thanks to our director, Patrice Martin, our engineer, John Dryden. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Have a wonderful day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The U.S. Trade and Development Agency recently awarded a grant to the Nigerian company Community Social Enterprises Limited, or CESEL, for a feasibility study supporting the rollout of 25 solar photovoltaic microgrids across Nigeria. Together, the microgrids will produce more than 5 megawatts. This project will help Nigeria to capitalize on its tremendous solar energy potential by scaling up the deployment of off-grid generation and mini-grid systems, ultimately increasing access to electricity. The study will focus on providing solar energy for rural and peri-urban communities that generally lack reliable access to electricity. The microgrid systems will operate on a pay-as-you-go structure, using mobile payments, with production and consumption monitored on a real-time basis. This structure will ensure payment and sustainability, as well as provide consistent, reliable power at a lower price than diesel generators. CESEL selected the U.S. firm Renuvia Energy Corporation to conduct the feasibility study. The project presents opportunities for U.S. businesses to make sales in solar PV modules, batteries, electrical equipment, control systems, and meters across Nigeria. We are proud to connect CESEL with a leading U.S. company on this important project to expand energy access in Nigeria, said Lida Fitz, the U.S. Trade and Development Agency's Regional Director for Sub-Saharan Africa. We're delighted to be selected as technical services partner for this project with CESEL, said Trey Jared, CEO of Renuvia. We look forward to continuing development of solar microgrids in sub-Saharan Africa, and we're excited to play such an important role in helping to advance Nigeria's support for off-grid power. The grant was signed by the U.S. Consul General in Lagos, John Bray, and Dr. Patrick Tolani of CESEL. This project advances the goals of Power Africa to increase electricity connections and power generation. The U.S. Trade and Development Agency helps companies create U.S. jobs through the export of U.S. goods and services for priority development projects in emerging economies. USTDA links U.S. businesses to export opportunities by funding project planning activities, pilot projects, and reverse trade missions while creating sustainable infrastructure and economic growth in partner countries. the United States is proud to work with its partner Nigeria and the private sector to help meet the energy needs of the Nigerian people.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.